Hello, this is Martin on Radio Sangam, and welcome to the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture, and the people of the world. Very sorry, I'm a little bit starting today. The traffic was a little bit crazy. But listen, I can't believe it's been 3 weeks now since I was in prison. No, I wasn't locked up for my Liverpool accent, and nor did I commit any kind of crime. I was on a film set, a Bollywood film set, with some others from Radio Sangam, by the way. And anyway, while I was there, because it was set in a prison, what I realised was that the people who were dressed as prison officers started to embody the role. And the people who were dressed as prisoners, like me, we started to embody the role. Now, I'm not saying that we left the place and started to commit crimes or anything like that, but if any of you have heard of that experiment where they put people into a jail, and what started to happen was the prison officers, even if they went in with good spirits, started to have a certain attitude towards the prisoners and vice versa. I saw this at work. While I was in this prison, I noticed it. The prison officers were walking with a certain air about them because they were dressed as authority and they were getting on, and they were, you know, linking them. You know, they were more likely to stick together. And those prisoners were handling ourselves in a completely different way. But anyway, why am I talking about the prison after 3 weeks? Because I met a guy who was an officer there who was actually a former police officer and have been trained in riot control. And when I got to talk to him, he had the most amazing story. And it turned out that he'd been pivotal in creating some new procedures that really helped in the fight against crime. So I'm going to play another track, which will be Finally by CC Peniston. And then I'm going to bring my guest, Hugh Morgan, on air so you can hear him for yourself. So whatever you're doing today, I hope you're having a fantastic one. Stick with me until around 5, when the 5 o'clock news is on, and then Gia and Jared will be here to do their show. And a big thank you to Saeed for doing his show before as well. So, I've now got Hugh Morgan with me, who I met in prison. Hugh, thanks very much for, quote-unquote, being here today, because you're on the phone, aren't you?
I am. It's my pleasure, Martin, my pleasure.
So, I explained to our audience that there did seem to be a little bit of a divide between the officers and the prisoners. It must be a psychological effect. How did you find it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Definitely, I'm sure that if you put people in uniforms and you tell them to boss other people around, very quickly you split the group into two. I know there was a study done in the 1960s in America where they tried this with university students, and they found that the guards really got completely out of control and had to be restrained from treating the inmates, who were their peers, who were fellow students, badly. So there is definitely a link between given power and authority over people and it being occasionally abused. So yeah, there was definitely a feeling between us when we were on set.
So in terms of acting then, we'll have to start giving you some more criminal roles then, I think, just to counterbalance the fact that you played an officer a few times.
Yeah, I would be very happy to play a criminal. I think it's more fun to be a baddie. I was a baddie in a play once and got booed when I came on to take my bow at the end, and I felt that was the highest compliment possible because the person of the audience really thought I was a horrible person. Oh. So playing baddies is much more fun, I think.
I'll have to be careful of that when we're going into schools and doing motivational speeches. I don't want them all thinking I'm going in there to kill them. Right, so we're about to go to the ads. It's great to have you on the show. So this is Give a Little Bit by Supertramp, and it's the first one selected by my guest today, Hugh Morgan, who's going to be talking about his time in the police force. If you do want to get in touch during the interview, by the way, any questions or just to say hello, text us or WhatsApp us on 07444202155. Karashvili. That sounded like quite a chilled song. You might be able to hear it just a little bit in the background there. Got carried away chatting to my guest, Hugh Morgan, all about the acting and our time in prison. I do hope we meet again on set, Hugh.
Yeah, so do I. I'm sure we will. Hopefully doing something as exciting as we did a few weeks ago.
Well, you know, ironically, you know, we were chatting about what to send to the casting agent the other day in terms of photos. And last night I was at a wedding, 3-piece suit, tie, goatee beard, you know, really neat and tidy. I think I still look like a criminal. I just look more like a mafia boss. All I needed was the scar down the face, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So, I've told everybody that you were quite pivotal in changing procedures and stuff like that within the police force, and really made a difference to the fighting against crime. And you know, everyone knows now that you were involved in riot training, but you know, them and myself don't really know that much about what's involved with that. But there are some other skills that come to the table in your case that you end up applying to your job as a police officer. So for that reason alone, it's worth us doing what I normally do and going back to childhood and just finding out a little bit about who Hugh Morgan is and where he began. So obviously you've got a plum in your mouth compared to me. Where are you from?
I was born in Cardiff, in Wales.
Oh, right.
But my parents moved to Bristol when I was quite young. I just never picked up any kind of regional accent. I lived in Bristol for quite a few years and then moved to London when I was a young adult and then back to the West Country. And I've just never picked up any kind of accent. My father has quite a strong, or had quite a strong Welsh accent, and my mother has no accent. I just didn't pick one up. It's just one of those things.
It's a great skill for an actor, isn't it, to be able to just speak clearly in a neutral voice?
Well, it's interesting. When originally, way back, actors who had regional accents used to have them sort of taught out of them, so they'd actually be taught to speak the Queen's English, as it was called then, and to remove the accent altogether, which was a real shame. Nowadays, with actors, with actor training, they're taught how to speak the Queen's English, or received pronunciation, whatever you want to call it, but they are also encouraged, very strongly encouraged, to keep and maintain their original accent, because those are often very, very useful, particularly if you're casting somebody and you want that diversity, you want something who's a bit edgy. So having a strong regional accent is now considered a bonus in acting, as well as being able to speak without an accent.
Well, you know, I think I've now got what they call radio scouse, although people will still try to tell me I've got a broad accent, which I don't think I have. Quick question for you.
Yeah.
Because we've got to go to your next track in about 40 seconds. Did you have any idea that you'd end up being an actor or a police officer when you were younger?
When I was younger, I was desperate to work in the entertainment industry, either in television, film or theatre, either in front of or behind the camera. So I always wanted to do it, but I didn't know which area I'd end up in. But I'm delighted now as a retired policeman to be doing something you know, that does involve acting. So yeah, that's great for me.
That's great. Well, listen, just tell me quickly before I put it on, what made you pick Nowhere Man by the Beatles, which is your next track?
Well, I think the Beatles were the best band ever. I absolutely loved them. And I thought Nowhere Man is a record that isn't played as often as some of their other big hits. So that's why I chose it. I love it.
Well, I share your perspective. Let's listen to it. Nowhere Man by the Beatles, and that'll take us. Sorry, James. You just have to sit down, because I've got a radio interview to do. There you go, I've told James to sit down, but we can still hear him slightly. Welcome back to The Culture Pop, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. I'm Martin Morrison, and I'm chatting to actor and former police officer Hugh Morgan. We've been having a right old chinwag, as you do. So, Hugh, so you knew that you wanted to be on the screen, right? And yeah. It's so weird you're saying that, because this morning my partner was listening to a motivational speaker, and he was talking about, as a 10-year-old, how he was absolutely determined he was going to be on TV. So you have been on TV, and now you've been in a Bollywood film as well, so that's all good. Did you ever think in a million years that you'd be a copper?
Not really, no. I always quite fancied the idea, but it was never more than just a sort of fantasy. And then I met my wife, and she said, you really need to sort yourself out and get a decent job. And so she was the one who encouraged me to join the police. And I initially joined the Special Constabulary, who were the voluntary police. And I did that for a couple of years. And while I was doing that, I thought, actually, I think I could do this job quite well. I think it would suit my personality. So I then started the process of joining the regular police.
Okay, but let's just go back a little bit further, because I know that you had an interest in photography. Is that something that came about while you were in the police, or did that happen before when you were a kid?
Oh no, I've always been absolutely mad about photography and filmmaking. That's something I've enjoyed ever as long as I can remember. I had a camera when I was very, very young. I used to borrow the family 8mm film camera and used to make little films with my sisters in the back garden and used to muck about with that. So I've always had an interest in moving pictures and in still pictures, and that was something that I then incorporated into my work in the police.
That's right. Now you've jumped the gun there. I'm trying to create a little bit of suspense and you sort of bang straight in there. But you know, but it's weird because it's just dawned on me now, I suppose. When you and I discussed this in prison, I never really thought about the connection between you being a filmmaker and you being involved in acting. I just thought about the objective of how it come about, which we're going to get to, of how you end up using your camera for the police. But look, before we sort of spill the beans, just tell me a little bit, we've got almost 2 minutes. Tell me a little bit about what you were doing in the police and what the weakness was, where there was a lacking, where there was a gap that needed to be filled, because that's what you ended up doing.
Well, that's right. Well, we found that often at events, particularly if there was public disorder, so not necessarily a riot, but where people were smashing bottles or damaging cars, misbehaving, fighting, there are a lot of people doing that, and you'd have all the police would turn up. The police would see a bunch of lads and lasses misbehaving and eventually would move in and arrest them. And they were completely legitimate arrests, and then they'd get back to the police station and then find that they couldn't attribute specific crimes or specific offences to individual people. They'd say, well, I know this lad was throwing punches and he threw some stuff and he smashed something, but I can't tell you exactly what. And without having all that really clear evidence, obviously you couldn't charge people, you couldn't put them before the courts, and so they were never held accountable for their damaging and bad behaviour, so they would often get away with it. So it was decided that we would have to have a process where we could capture the evidence to prove they'd committed the offences, and the best way to do that is to take photographs and to take film, because then you can show the pictures and the images to them and to the courts if necessary, and that way you can get convictions and hold people accountable to their bad behaviour, because often they're ruining people's businesses, their property, and often hurting folk. So it's important that we stop that.
Okay, well look, we're going to come back to that, because I've got some further questions for you that come to mind about the past.
Sure.
So before we do that, let's listen to your next track, which is the 1957 song by Elvis Presley, Teddy Bear. Any particular reason why you wanted this?
I just love it. Whenever I hear Elvis singing Teddy Bear, it just brings a big smile to my face, and that makes me very happy.
Okay, well let it bring a smile to everyone else's face. Here we go. So that's the B-52s, Rock Lobster. What a fantastic name for a track, Rock Lobster. Okay, I think I could do with that for my road rage as well, because, you know, some of the things I shout when I'm driving are not good. You know, I can just see it now, be at a roundabout or something. Where's your indication, you Rock Lobster? You know, you could shout that out of the window, couldn't you? You rock lobster. So, we were talking about the fact that before, when there was, like, riots or just unrest in the street, the problem was, you drag in all these people who were involved, and you could say, they were there, I saw them, and he punched him, and he smashed stuff up. Well, what did he smash up? Well, just stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you couldn't pin anything down, so you'd bring them in, you'd have them in there for a few hours in the cells, I'm guessing, and then you'd have to let them go. And at the same time, the coppers were not really accountable either, because nothing was on camera. And I'm guessing that there was probably a lot of frustration, which probably, we often think of the bad old days when police brutality was more commonplace. I think it's less commonplace now because they're all wearing, you know, cameras and everything. But it almost makes you think, if you're in a situation where you can see that somebody's just smashed up someone else's car, burnt down somebody else's livelihood, you just might want to give them a little bit of an elbow in the face before you release them, because you can't get them into court. And is that what was going on?
I'm sure it did happen. I've got to say that in my service, I never witnessed that, but I know that it certainly has happened. There's no doubt. It'd be naive to say it didn't happen. And certainly a spin-off from having, as you say, police officers carrying body cameras, I'm absolutely convinced that the police behaviour has improved. And I think it's been improving a lot anyway. Certainly when I joined the police, there was absolutely zero tolerance to anybody going over the top and unnecessarily thumping somebody that was basically hadn't been caught doing anything specific. You couldn't go over the top. You couldn't thump somebody. You couldn't resort to police brutality. That was something that was absolutely forbidden. I never witnessed that happening, but I'm sure it must have done at some point in some parts of the country. And having cameras is certainly definitely going to reduce that. It certainly has improved the behaviour of people who otherwise would have probably gone over the top themselves. So having cameras generally is a good thing.
Well, I've got to say that as a Scouser, being raised as a teen in the 80s in Toxteth, or very near Toxteth, we were all terrified of those Black Mariahs. That we'd never seen them before, and now they were out. That's what we used to call them. And the rumour was that the coppers would come, they'd skid next year, they decided to pick on you. And it was like a stop and search plus extra. And they'd drag you into the back of the van, and God knows what would happen to you inside that van, because nobody could see what was going on. And then you'd be kicked out. That was the rumour that we used to hear.
And I'm sure that happened. Certainly, I joined the police in 1990, and I was not aware of that happening at all, certainly where I was working, but I'm not saying it wasn't happening in other places. In the 80s, I'm sure it was more prevalent, and I think I think the situation's become better and better as the police have become more professional and more accountable, but there's no doubt that it happened in the past.
It's a tough job. I've been saying to somebody only this morning, they've cut all these coppers. They're saying that they're taking on 20,000 more now. But a lot of people are laughing at that because they got rid of at least 20,000 a few years ago. And it seems to be a dangerous game. Not wanting to go too much into politics, but it seems to be a dangerous game when you've got so much controversy going on at the moment with so many policies. And yet you've got the army cut and the police cut. It just seems like a recipe for civil unrest. But that's a different show. What I wouldn't mind delving into now is your... before we talk more about what you did as a filmmaker, is to look at your riot training, because you were one of the first officers to be trained in, like, how to deal with riots, weren't you?
And I wasn't one of the first to be trained in how to deal with riots, but I was quite early on in the process of making sure that we photographed and videoed what was happening in riots to a high professional standard. When I joined the police, I became a riot officer very early on in my career. I was aware that we were using these police officers with cameras, with video cameras and still cameras,
And because of my experience in photojournalism, when I'd been younger, and my experience with using video cameras and still cameras, I could see areas where we could become even more professional and better. So I got on one of these courses, and at the end of the course said, thank you for the training, I think I can make it even better. And that's when I really got involved. But that was quite early on in the days of videoing and photographing riots, but there'd been riot police for many, many years before that.
Okay.
Before I was even a policeman.
Let's have a listen to One More Chance by the Notorious B.I.G. That's good, isn't it? We're going from talking about law and order to somebody who's notorious. But God rest his soul. This is One More Chance. And then we'll have a little... I just want to delve more deeply into the standard riot training. Because for you, it'll be second nature. But for a lot of us, you know, we can only experience it through... So, I'm going to interrupt Us Palkar Har Mausam, which is by DJ Lina Shah. Probably mispronounced it, but he gave it my best shot. To continue my interview with Hugh Morgan, who used to be a police officer. He was trained in riot control, and he was also, he ended up advancing police evidence gathering techniques. So, we were talking about the riot training, and I got it wrong. You weren't one of the first to be trained in riot training, but all the same, it's the sort of stuff that you've done is something that 99% of the population won't have done. Even people like me, who's done quite advanced self-defense stuff, I don't know what it's like to be in a riot. So, you know, what sort of elements were incorporated in that training? What was the objectives for you to come away with, if you like? They're taking these raw officers and saying, right, we want you to be ready for a riot. Go through the elements of what you covered.
Sure. I mean, when we started with the students, we would explain to them that we had tried all other tactics, everything else had broken down, so we tried community policing, we tried every other opportunity to prevent the riot from continuing, from happening. So we were saying, right, a riot has happened, we are now in a riot situation, and that's where we're going to start with. And obviously we would teach the students how to put on the various protective equipment. Obviously they were wearing special overalls, they were fire resistant, and various bits of padding and protective equipment, along with a helmet, shield, the stuff that you see on TV. So then they'd be taught how to put that equipment on so it would work properly, and then we would teach them the different instructions so they would know how to move around in a group, and they would be split up into little teams to work together. And then they'd be taught the various tactics in order to, you know, move around safely so they didn't get injured, so they weren't, the people didn't come around from behind them and catch them out. So they were taught basic moving tactics, and then they'd be taught how to deal with situations if people were throwing things at them. So we would throw wooden blocks and what have you at them to try and create a realistic training situation, but making it as safe as possible as well.
And you actually threw real petrol bombs at each other, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, part of the training was to expose students to petrol bombs being thrown at them. The last thing anybody wants is to see anybody being injured, so safety was absolutely scrupulously adhered to. And we would always have people with fire extinguishers just in case, you know, a student needed to be put out for effectively if some petrol got on their clothing and hadn't gone out properly, then we could douse it with a fire extinguisher. That was very, very rare. And there'd also be trained medics and first aiders all around, and somebody supervising the whole situation. And it was done in a very controlled and safe way, but it was extremely realistic, and they did feel the heat of the flames. And with making them, preparing them for the situation where they might really be petrol bombed. So it was an essential part of the training. And in of all the training that I did, nobody was ever injured, which was a credit to the techniques we were employing.
Sounds like great adrenal stress training. Just an observation that I would make. I think that when you look at modern warfare, as the weapons have become more powerful, we've moved away from the kind of training and tactics that would have been used by some of the greatest warriors on earth, the Romans. But when you look at what happens in riots, because the weapons tend to be more basic, missiles, hand-to-hand and all the rest of it, I would say that when you see the officers with the shields and all the gear on, it very much is a throwback to what the Roman soldiers would have been doing 2,000 years ago.
You're absolutely right. You've hit the nail on the head. When I did my when I was being trained to be an instructor in riot control, we were told a lot of the tactics we were employing were in fact used by Roman soldiers. You're absolutely right. We would have a similar size and similar shaped.
Hugh, we've got to go to the news. If you're wondering what all that cheering was, that's the introduction to Three Lions, Badil Skinner and the Lightning. So, as per usual, I've been having a right chinwag with my friend here, Hugh Morgan, my guest today. Even though we only had a chat a few days ago, didn't we?
We did.
But we got rudely interrupted by the news before. Now, I didn't listen to it, but I guarantee it was boring and it was bad news, because that's all they ever play. They don't play any good news. It's always bad news. So we carried on where we left off. So we were talking before, and this was something that you and I hadn't discussed, this idea that the way you guys were trained for riots was absolutely identically copying what the Romans did. Because I guess the circumstances were the same, the streets were maybe a little bit different, but pretty much it was primitive battle between two groups, and so you guys moved, operated, protected yourselves like the Romans. But then you and I got into quite an interesting chat about how the armour evolved. Because when I was giving a talk to school kids the other day about, changing their story, understanding that it was their narrative about themselves that would determine how well they did in life, and I said to them, a lot of the time people think that success is born of success, that when you come from a wealthy family, you'll do well. And to show them that I did not come from a wealthy family, I showed them the Toxteth Riots. And, it really grabbed them. And I described the coppers as looking like stormtroopers. But there was a reason why they looked like stormtroopers. You gave me quite a good account of how it developed. Just share that with our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Back in the very early 1980s, those listeners old enough to remember this but might remember the riots that were on the news in St. Paul's and Bristol, and also in London. Now, I was living in London in the early 80s, and I witnessed some of these riots. And the police then, most of them, didn't have the right equipment to protect themselves. Certainly in St. Paul's, they were using dustbin lids, milk bottle containers to protect themselves from people throwing stones and bottles at them. And their helmets weren't offering any kind of protection. So the police would then go away, get the necessary equipment to protect themselves, and that was often shields that the military had been using, perhaps in Northern Ireland. And they would then bring that equipment onto the streets in order that they didn't get hurt. And then people would throw petrol bombs, and the police would react by then going and finding fire-retardant garments to wear, and it was obvious to have a bullet in the suits because that was much easier to put on quickly. And as this threat changed, and as people, the rioters became more dangerous and were throwing more stuff, the police had to evolve and adapt in order not to get injured, just to survive. And that's where the riot policeman has come from. The evolution has been caused by the behaviour of that small minority in the communities who are rioting.
Okay, and one of the other things that we discussed when we were off air as well was, just the idea of violence. You said to me explicitly that none of the coppers wanted to do the riot training. That it was the last thing that they wanted to do was to get involved in fights or to get involved in, splitting communities and getting involved in near military warfare with them. And that was interesting because a lot of people have an image in their heads of coppers really wanting to have a good scrap, don't they?
They do, and it's a very, very common misperception. And I must admit, when I joined the police, I assumed that the police were far more far more likely to get into confrontations than they did. And actually, the vast majority of policemen, police officers, I'm talking across the board, would go to great lengths to avoid a fight. Very, very, very few police officers, in my experience, want to get into any kind of physical confrontation. That 99 times out of 100, they'll definitely try and talk their way out of the trouble. And the thought that a police officer would have to don protective equipment in his or her neighbourhood and to protect themselves against a handful of people who want to cause trouble is heartbreaking. And I think it's a very common misapprehension. I'm not really sure where it's come from, maybe historically, but very, very few police want to fight. The vast majority of us just wanted to go home at the end of our shift. If you did get into any kind of scrap, you'd end up spending hours and hours and hours doing paperwork, and you could have something you might be able to avoid. So, you know, from my experience, police officers very, very rarely want to get into a fight. If you want to get into a fight, you might want to join the army or perhaps a boxing club, but you certainly don't join the police. My experience of it was that in the first 2 years, when you're doing your probation, if somebody does have a temperament that's not appropriate because they're aggressive, they'd be weeded out anyway, so, which is a good thing, obviously.
And that is a good thing. And I just want to say for anybody listening here that it'd be very easy if, for example, you were still an acting policeman. People might go, "Oh yeah, well, you know, he's gonna say that." But I'm not gonna talk about your story in depth. All I will say is you haven't been a police officer for a number of years now. You've got no axe to grind. There's no reason for you to stick up for the forces in any shape or form. You know, you're giving quite an objective account about a part of your life that is now gone. And I think that's really important, because there is definitely still elements of police brutality. There's still elements where, you know, people go wrong. I think they've got it more wrong in America, to be honest. And that's a different conversation that we had, isn't it?
Yes, and it's a very, very different culture. I mean, the without getting, you know, deep into it, with America, you've got so many guns, and it's the prevalence of guns, more guns than people. That's the really big difference.
Sorry, you know what I'm thinking?
And also cultural differences.
Let's play your next track. I've been moving it on. Let's play The Candyman. By Sammy Davis Jr. And then we'll have that chat about America, because I know you went over there. So we'll have a chat about the comparison and contrast between US forces and British forces. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely.
Great. Here's The Candyman. I'm having a chat with Hugh Morgan, my guest today. And we've been talking about having a heart of standing there. You know, it's not really about being a scrapper. It's about being prepared to accept the consequences of standing up for what's right. And that's the sort of people that we need in the police force, really, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah.
So we're at 16:25, Hugh. So we've still got time to go piece by piece into the improvements, if you like, that you made to evidence gathering. And I think that'll be quite interesting. But I'm still interested in the other chats that we've had. So you and I had a chat about in my opinion, our police officers are the most well trained in the world. It's not easy out there to go out when you've got guns and all kinds, and most of our officers haven't got any real weapons, you know. But you went over to America and saw a completely different scenario over there. Just talk to us a little bit about that. Compare and contrast the two forces and the training.
Sure. I mean, I went to America on several occasions, and this wasn't done through work. This was me just making contact with the local police when I went out there. But I went out on patrol on quite a few occasions with police from all over the states, from New York right up to Washington and Seattle, which is right across the states. And I found that the kind of people who were in the police in America were people that I got on very, very well with, but they had a completely different job to do. It was totally different, and I asked them what you see as being your biggest challenges, and they said that gangs was a massive problem in America, and that was a problem that at the time we didn't have in the UK. And the second biggest problem was guns, because there are so many guns, everybody well, not everybody has a gun, but there are more guns than people, and guns are very, very common. And handguns can be very small. And they said, so every time they would be dealing with somebody, even if the person didn't seem hostile, that person could be carrying a gun, and they could snuff that police officer's life out in the blink of an eye. So they had a completely different job to do than the job that the police in Britain were doing, where guns are far less common. In my service, I saw very few guns. I was working in a city where there weren't many, but guns are so much rarer in the UK. So that was a very, very big difference, I noticed. But also with the way that the funding in America was done, the Americans spend far more money, it appears, per capita than we do on policing. So the police officers that I was hanging out with would have their own cruiser, their own police car, often with their name on it, and that car would be configured for them. So the way the radio was set up, the way the spotlight was set up, the way the guns were held in the vehicle were done down to that police officer's particular taste. And they would take that car out when they went on patrol, and nobody else would. Whereas in the UK, you'd have a large team of police officers and maybe only had three or four cars to share amongst them. So funding was another very, very big difference. I don't know if you want me to give you more specifics on that, Martin.
I'm just wondering, something just popped up in my head that might seem a little bit random. But obviously, everyday people, we get the impression that the police are very straight-laced and they've all got the guards up and they won't really say boo to each other about their lives because everyone's watching each other. Or maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just my paranoia coming out. So if you were out on patrol with somebody else in a cop car, would you talk? Would you ever listen to the radio? Like the radio, music, as you're driving along until you get a call in? Or was it... And if you did, was that off the record? Just give us a little bit about the experience.
I've got to say, I've never, ever put the normal radio on when I've been on duty. But when I was on duty with somebody, so if I was paired up with somebody, then we would normally be sent... We would come on duty regardless of the shift, and we would be usually sent to a job, some kind of incident, whether it was a burglary or an assault or road accident or whatever. We would be sent to a job, we would drive there, deal with the incident, tell the radio control room that we had we'd turned up, what we had done, and then we would either do the paperwork or we would then move on to the next job. So literally you'd go from job to job to job. There was very little time during the early shift and the late shift to have any sort of social chit-chat time. In my experience, the most likely time the police officers would chat, would talk personally, would be on the night shift, when generally it was quieter, certainly midweek. At the weekends, obviously, it'd be very busy. So it's I don't know if that's what people expect it to be like, but for me, we were normally busy for our entire shift, apart from occasionally on nights. And that's when you could chat to people about family, about your lives outside the police world.
Okay, so any images that I've got here of, like, coppers, you know, riding along, watching all the traffic around them while listening to Stuck in the Middle with You by Jerry Rafferty, it's a myth. It didn't happen.
I wish. That'd be great. No, I mean, you could still enjoy yourself, you could still have fun and get on well with the person you were working with, but it was very much, for me, it was very, very much a job. You'd turn up and you'd go to your first incident, because the control room where, on the people on the radio were telling us where to go, they would be being sent lots of information, lots of jobs, so people would be ringing up saying...
So I'm interrupting Armed and Extremely Dangerous by First Choice. Instead of that, you can have this Unarmed and Extremely Dangerous radio presenter, Martin Morrison, with The Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. I've been chatting to Hugh Morgan all about his time in the police. If you've found the conversation interesting and you've got any quirky questions, I've asked him if police officers listen to music in their cars, you know, anything goes here, then send me a text or a WhatsApp message on 07444 202 155. So that's 07444202155. I'm kind of glad I didn't get into the police force now, knowing that I wouldn't be able to listen to Purple Rain while I was driving around. So we're entering the last part of our interview. So as much as you can, anyway, I would like you to talk about, because you said to me that by the time you were getting involved in the evidence-gathering aspect of your work, they had already started to do this. They already had photographers taking photographs and videos, but you improved them big time. Take us through that step by step, because me, I'm curious about stuff like this, and I think that anyone who's listened to the Culture Pot on a regular basis will by now also be quite a curious person. Otherwise, they would have tuned out. So, fill us in.
Well, what happened was I did this course with my home force, and I enjoyed it, but I felt there were areas where we could do better. So I had a chat with the trainers and explained my background and my experiences, and they were very happy for me to sort of join the team. And what we did was we sat down and looked at all the different methods that were being used about taking the pictures and then matching those pictures up to the video footage you had of the different offenders, and making sure that you could link the offence to the offender. And we talked about dealing with that by having a good commentary. So the person who was watching the guy, should we say, throwing a rock at someone's car, the person would give a description of that person, describe what they were doing, and video it at the same time, and then you have the still photographer will be taking pictures, hopefully of that same person, because you'd have them working in little teams. And I guess that this was happening all over the country. I'd already been teaching this discipline in my own force and in neighbouring forces, and then I managed to get the opportunity to work with an agency inside the police but wasn't my own home force. And I talked to them and said that I would like to see how evidence gathering is done in different parts of the country. And so I was given the opportunity to travel all over England and Wales to meet the people who were doing the evidence gathering training in those different parts of the country. And I would go and visit them, watch their training, talk to the trainers, talk to the students, look at the equipment they were using and the different tactics. And then I would take the best ideas that I consider to be the best ideas from those different forces and then integrate them into one big package. So I researched how evidence gathering was done all over England and Wales. Not every single force, but the ones that were most cooperative and helpful. I would talk to them, visit them, take their best ideas, and then develop one big training package. And then once I developed this package, I wrote the package myself. So I would basically just cherry-pick all the best ideas from all over the country and then put them together in one big training package, which could then be delivered by trained specialists all over the country. So basically, I was setting a standard, one standard training package for the whole of England and Wales, instead of each different constabulary, each different force having their own training packages, because put all together, we had a really good package, but individually, we were missing out. Does that make sense?
Yes. So I'm guessing here that some of the issues that you would encounter without this training, or even with some of the training that you were witnessing, if they dropped the ball, were things like the photographer not working in harmony with the filmmaker. So you know, they had less, they couldn't do as much with it. Whereas if they had somebody taking still shots at the same time as somebody was taking video shots, if they were working in harmony, that evidence would be more powerful, I'm guessing?
Absolutely, definitely. So what we discovered is that the most important thing was that the people who were taking the pictures and doing the commentary were safe. So you'd have to have a little team. You might have to have several people in a small team, and only one of them actually be doing the photography or the videography. The other people would be protecting the photographer, and maybe somebody else would be aware of what was going on around and communicating with the stills photographer. So sometimes they'd be working next to each other, and they would identify who they were interested in, and as you said, they could concentrate on getting good still pictures of the person doing whatever they were doing they shouldn't be doing, and the videographer getting the moving pictures. And this is, we've got to remember now, we're talking quite some time ago, I'm sure it's moved on a lot since, but the cameras were normal domestic video cameras. They weren't state-of-the-art TV cameras because they would cost far too much and be much too big and heavy. And also this equipment was getting battered around a fair bit. So we were using relatively old-fashioned cameras compared to today's high-resolution cameras and high-definition cameras. But yeah, it was basically looking at all the best practices and putting those together and then having one training package which could then be delivered to all the different sources, and so everyone was working to the same standard. And that was my aim, and that's what I developed over a period of time.
And what other standards did you set then? So you've looked at the communication that would go on between the photographer and the videographer. You've looked at the commentary that they should be reading, that they should be coming out with to accompany the footage. And I'm guessing that you probably looked at the format to that commentary as well, what should be included and what shouldn't be included. What else did you standardise?
Once you've got the images, the video images and the still images, then you need to identify who these different people are. And so we would have to put in place protocols where the images of the suspects could be viewed by police officers in a way that was safe. So you wouldn't have somebody saying, that looks like such and such, or that looks like so and so. So we would have to make sure we had very strict and clear ways of police officers viewing the individual photographs to make sure that they correctly identify suspects. And you wouldn't just have a group of police officers sitting around a table saying, that photograph looks like this person or that person. So we had to make sure those protocols were put in place so that the evidence was dealt with and handled in a way that was completely fair and ethical and correct, because obviously the consequences for some of these people might end up being prison if they'd committed a serious enough crime. Mm-hmm. So part of my job was also to make sure that we didn't just train people to take the images properly and correctly, but once they got those images, that they were handled in a way that was ethical. And when digital technology came along, we had to make sure that the digital material was handled in a way which was ethical and legal as well. So that was an additional challenge.
Okay, so I'm just wondering if you got involved with the hiring of, for example, super recognizers?
No. When digital technology really sort of came into its fall, that's when I moved away from that particular area. And there have been lots of progressions in technology since I was involved in evidence gathering, which I don't know about, so I'm not qualified to discuss. When I was doing it, we were doing the transition from 35mm, from wet photography to digital photography. And that was a big, big change because of the way that we handled the material.
Okay. And you also went around the country delivering the training, and in the end, the new unified training, or did you have to train other trainers?
I didn't. Although I developed the research and wrote the training package, I unfortunately, for reasons I won't bore you with, I didn't end up delivering that. I did deliver training in my own force and other forces before that, but once I'd finished my training package, as I say, I wasn't involved in delivering that training, which is a real shame, but something that was out of my control at the time.
Okay, well, look, we're going to play another track. I don't think it was one of yours, but it's in the system and it's there. It's not a bad record. By Waze and Odyssey and R. Kelly, we've got Bump and Grind 2014 version. So we're nearing the end of our interview today. I've been chatting to Hugh Morgan, who left the police force 2.5 years ago. I met him on the set of a Bollywood film in a prison, where he was playing a prison officer, and I, of course, was a prisoner. And, you know, it's weird because sometimes when I bring guests on, they're life coaches or they're business mentors or they've got a website. And, you know, I'm quite happy for them to market their services as long as they give me a good interview. In Hugh's case, he's, you know, a budding actor, and I just thought it'd be a good story to share. But while we've been chatting off air, I said to Hugh, well, look, we've got 5 minutes. Let's talk about, you know, how you ended up being an actor and what skills you've taken from your time in the police and how you might reapply them. But he turned it on its head, really, and said that in his experiencing, policing has always been about what, Hugh?
Well, being an actor, basically. If I can go right back to when I was first doing my basic training, so this is long before I went onto the streets, the method that we were taught was to set up a situation. Let's say you'd have a group of police students, a dozen police students, and the trainer would say, right, we're going to have a situation here. Let's pretend we've got a domestic dispute, and I have two people who are going to be the two people arguing, a couple of other people who are going to be the police officers, nobody else will be watching. And we used to video this, so you'd have a police officer videoing police officers pretending to be people who were experiencing a crime, and people who are pretending police officers. They're not police officers yet, they're trainees, and their peers standing around. So they actually used role play and acting, play acting, to teach police officers how to be police officers. We're talking about trainees right in the early days of training, and then this was ramped up as you went through our training. And then when you went onto the streets, you would find you would be using the acting skills that you were developing to deal with situations. If you imagine a brand new 20-year-old police officer turning up to a situation that they would really feel out of their depth in, they would have to use some kind of skill to manage that. And they were using acting skills, even if they didn't know it. This is what my thoughts on it anyway. And I think it's true of several professions where you develop acting skills in order to manage your day-to-day work. For example, if you're a vicar, you might need to do that. If you're a solicitor, you probably certainly would in court. And maybe if you're a teacher, you'd be using acting skills. So there are certain professions that teach you how to be an actor. And I think that being a police officer, a lot of skills you learn are acting skills, whether you know it or not. And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, it was funny when you said that, because I completely agreed. I meet a lot of guests or potential guests at the Professional Speaking Association, an organisation I've become a member because I've started to do increasingly more talks to people like school children, business groups and the rest of it. And what's dawned on me, I was there yesterday, what dawns on me when I see some of these speakers is that if you didn't know these people behind the scenes and you just went to see a talk, and you see someone like Steve Jobs, for example, the late great Steve Jobs, you see them give this talk and it sounds so passionate and, you know, they're great orators and they're great at getting a message across, but they are acting. You see them, the whole perception, the whole image, the whole persona changes dramatically as soon as they get up on the stage. And I can really relate with what you've said. Also from a self-defense perspective, if you're in a situation and you've got somebody who's big and brutal and about to mug you, it's amazing how much difference it'll make if you know how to be convincingly hard or convincingly not afraid, at least. That can make a massive difference on whether you live or die. Maybe we're all actors, all of us.
You could be right, yeah. I mean, and it's not a criticism of police officers to say that they use acting skills. I'm not suggesting they're being phony or false or dishonest in any way. I think what they're doing is they're seeing, right, I need to take on this kind of persona here. I need to be dominant or in charge or assertive or reassuring. And I might be a little bit nervous or scared myself and be a bit out of my depth. But if I pretend that I'm in control and I pretend that I know what I'm doing, then that's going to reassure the public. And it does. And I've witnessed myself doing it. And then, funnily enough, your confidence grows, your ability grows, and then you're not acting, you're actually doing the job properly. So I think it's a, a good thing and something I think that we should be proud of, that we have people who have that skill. And we so carefully choose and select our police nowadays that we are picking the most admirable people, people with such wonderful qualities, to do what I think is probably one of the most important jobs in society. And developing those acting skills is just one of the many things that they have to develop and learn as they support their communities.
By the way, how did you, you left the force, how did you stumble upon acting as a profession? What happened?
Well, it's very kind of you to say it's a profession. It's more of something that I'm passionate about than being a profession. Well, I've always wanted to do it ever since I was a kid. I was talked out of pursuing a career in acting by one of my best friends at school, whose dad was a professional theatre director, and he said, it's such a tough industry to get into, pick something else. So I took his advice. Maybe if I made the right decision or not, I'll never know. But I got into the acting I'm doing now through one professional local theatre, musical theatre, in Bath, which is where I live currently. And I absolutely loved that, and so when I left the police, I thought, well, I shall pursue this even further.
Great. And I have to ask the question. Obviously, you've got filmmaking skills. You've got bags of experiences that most of the people don't get, including all kinds of film sets. Have you ever thought about maybe progressing things from the other side of the camera and making films, movies, screenplays, whatever?
I have, yeah, and it's something I'm looking into. I personally think that I would probably be more successful behind the camera than in front of it, but it's something I need to pursue. At the moment, I'm enjoying showing off in front of the camera and on stage, but maybe I should start thinking about getting behind the camera, because I might be more successful there. Who knows? I'll have to give that a try.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to chat to you today. You're always very easy to get on with. It's, it's a real pleasure knowing you, Hugh. So thanks very much for giving me your time today.
Thank you, Martin. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Would you like to say anything to our friends at home?
Well, if anybody is listening in, and I'm sure there are lots of people listening in, then I hope you've enjoyed the programme. Tune in next week to hear Martin again. And thank you for this opportunity. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Isn't that lovely? Isn't it lovely how we told you to tune in and listen to my dulcet tones again next week? He must be mad. So, but he's right. Thank you very much for listening to the Culture Pot today. Just so you know, the latest person I've got in mind for you, if you're fans of Britain's Got Talent, is a lady called Christina, who was very famous on Britain's Got Talent because she's a hypnotist and she had a hypnotic dog. I've not actually seen her act, but she used her hypnotic dog to hypnotise the panellists on Britain's Got Talent. But she's a remarkable woman with a great life, and she'll be talking all about how you can take control of your life by taking care of your mindsets. So that's all for now. Take care of yourselves. God bless. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Kirklees one and only Asian Radio.